Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, and welcoming our guest, Dr. David Perlmutter. Dr. Perlmutter is a world-renowned board-certified neurologist, a fellow of the American College of Nutrition, and co-founder and president of the Perlmutter Brain Foundation. He has helped increase awareness of the critical role nutrition and lifestyle factors can play in the prevention of neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, depression, and ADHD. Dr. Perlmutter has received numerous awards for innovative work in brain research, including the Humanitarian of the Year Award and the Linus Pauling Award. He's written 4 New York Times best-selling books, including Grain Brain, Brain Maker, The Power of Gut Microbes to Heal and Protect Your Brain for Life, and his most recent book, The Grain Brain Whole Life Plan. So now, David, my dad and I are so grateful to you for your brilliant, innovative work, and we're so glad to have this time with you. And now, for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, David, for being with us again.
Well, I'm delighted to be back in touch with you guys. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I've been thinking about you and your work and the brain-gut connection and the fact that every year something like 5 million Americans are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And that number keeps growing. It's expected to triple in the next 12 years. We do not have a treatment that works. We do not have a cure. What has led you to seriously consider and explore the possibility that the origin of Alzheimer's, and for that matter, many other serious neurological disorders, might likely be in the gut rather than in the brain?
It's an excellent question, and I think, you know, this really stems from my dissatisfaction many years ago with sort of brain-centric approaches to dealing with not just Alzheimer's, but anything neurologic. You know, when you understand that the body is, in fact, an integrated whole, that all parts influence each other and create a system that works well when all the parts are working appropriately, again, I thought that just focusing on the brain was very myopic. And, you know, clearly, as it relates to Alzheimer's disease, it did not then and does not now provide any meaningful approach to dealing with not only preventing this disease, but certainly trying to cure it or at least ameliorate it from a symptomatic perspective. So my journey began 3 decades ago looking at nutrition, and hence that obviously led to the gut. There was even in those days some the primordial stages of understanding that, hey, what you eat plays a role in your health. Who knew? And it turns out that, you know, people sort of rejected the notion that food could have any influence on the brain. But with time, more and more research was published demonstrating that diet clearly affects the brain's destiny, clearly affects how the brain functions moment to moment. And with that exploration of diet, it clearly was not, you know, difficult to connect the dots to the gut in general, and more recently to those organisms that live within the gut, and, you know, certainly opened up a brand new playing field for us to understand how the gut organisms influence brain health. So it's a very, very empowering time because we've got a lot of new information.
We do. It seems that a central feature of Alzheimer's, and in fact, most all of our dreaded brain and neurological diseases, is inflammation. You could say that inflammation is the cornerstone of Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and many of the other neurodegenerative ailments. What's the connection then, David, between inflammation in our bodies and brains and the condition of the lining of our guts?
Well, that's an excellent question. And you know, let me just extend that, if I could, that inflammation is really the cornerstone mechanism of all of our most dreaded degenerative conditions, including coronary artery disease, diabetes, and even cancer. So it's certainly within the brain and throughout the body that this inflammation is the central theme that runs across the spectrum of these degenerative conditions, which the World Health Organization tells us is the number one cause of death on planet Earth now. Not infectious disease, not war, not trauma, but chronic degenerative conditions. And what we've come to understand is that the set point, the balance point of inflammation in the body is really dictated by one fundamental issue, and that is the permeability or the leakiness of the gut lining. So when we lose the integrity of the gut lining, various types of proteins and other components that normally live in the gut can make their way across this now permeable defense barrier that's been broken down and get into the systemic circulation, challenging our immune cells, and that sets off these cascades of inflammation that affect everything from the brain to the heart to the skin to the joints. So here I am as a neurologist, a brain specialist, having a conversation with you about the importance to the brain of this one cell layer, this protection that guards the rest of the body from things that are going on within the intestines. Anything that we do that compromises that barrier integrity, that destabilizes the gates of defense, can lead to inflammation. This can be dietary issues, taking certain medications, which I hope we'll get a chance to talk about, drinking chlorinated water. All of these events tend to lead to that barrier being broken down, increasing its permeability. That sets the stage for inflammation, the cornerstone mechanism for just about every degenerative condition that you don't want to get.
Well, many people have heard about the perils of a leaky gut, and that happens when the protective junctions in the intestinal lining become compromised, as you've been describing. When that occurs, do undigested food particles leak into the bloodstream where they can elicit an immune response and lead to systemic inflammation?
Well, it's not specifically undigested food particles, but there are some very specific molecules that come across, including bacteria in and of themselves. So we can actually seed the rest of the body with bacteria based upon breakdown of the junctions between the cells that form this gut lining. But clearly, the substance that has been receiving the most attention is something called lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. And what LPS is, it's the covering over a large group of organisms that normally reside in the gut called gram-negative bacteria. But that particular chemical, LPS, when it transgresses the gut lining and gets into the systemic circulation, it's like lighting a match to gasoline. It just lights up inflammation throughout the body. And we can actually measure this LPS or an antibody response to LPS in a simple blood test. And in fact, that's commercially available for patients at their doctor's offices. And what we find is very interesting. We find that, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, which is classically thought to be a brain disorder, we see dramatic elevations of antibodies against LPS in the bloodstream, telling us two things. Number one, that the gut has become permeable, and number two, that inflammation has been amped up. We see it in Lou Gehrig's disease, in autism, and even in major depression, this dramatic elevation of measurable LPS telling us that, yes, indeed, the gut lining has become permeable and inflammation's been amped up.
So you do a blood test for LPS antibodies, and from that, you can assess the quality of the gut lining?
Exactly. That gives you a marker of the integrity of the gut lining, and it's also very useful then moving forward to see how effective are your interventions in terms of helping that individual. You really want that LPS level or the antibodies to come down with time. So if you've changed that person's diet to one that's more involved in catering to the gut bacteria, then that LPS should come down with time. Why do I say catering to the gut bacteria? Because a healthy microbiome, healthy gut bacteria with lots of diversity and good organisms will repair your gut lining. We know that certain organisms like oh, Lactobacillus plantarum, Lactobacillus rhamnosus, which are actually available as probiotics at the health food store, they make it their mission to heal up the gut lining, to seal up those tight junctions, and therefore reduce the stimulation that LPS is having upon the immune system. And it's not just amping up inflammation that becomes problematic. The very same mechanism is involved in causing imbalances of the immune system, which actually may explain this overactive immune system that so many people now in Western cultures are suffering from.
It always amazes me that the lining of our guts, that which separates what's inside of our digestive tract and what is inside the rest of our body, is, as you mentioned a moment ago, just a single cell thick. David, is this also true about the blood-brain barrier in the brain?
John, that's an excellent question. Because what we now recognize is some of the factors that lead to permeability of the gut lining are the exact same players that can actually lead to permeability or leakiness of the blood-brain barrier, which, you know, we thought had kept the brain sort of like a sanctuary and isolated from the possibility of contamination. You talk about a leaky gut. Let me tell you, a leaky brain is not a party. And we now know that gliadin, which is a protein found in part of gluten, also threatens not just the gut lining, but the brain protective blood-brain barrier as well.
Well, the blood-brain barrier is a network of endothelial cells that prevents substance in our blood from getting into the brain tissue. Some molecules can cross it and some can't. And this is necessary in order to maintain a favorable environment for the brain. David, can you describe what happens in a human brain if that barrier becomes too porous?
Absolutely. And indeed, it is really fairly similar to the gut lining in that it is one cell thick and that there are very tight junctions that occur between these endothelial cells. But again, we're talking one cell thick held together by some cement. And what we understand is you know, you have to be able to get things across your gut lining. You have to be able to absorb nutrients, for example. And we do that through our cells, which is a transcellular absorption, and we do it between our cells through these tight junctions that selectively allow certain things to get from inside the gut into your systemic circulation. Obviously, we need that, and the same thing happens in the brain. When the barrier is disrupted, however, then various proteins can get into the brain and elicit inflammatory responses. And when we recognize that Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS, autism are inflammatory disorders of the brain, then the idea of doing your very best to maintain the lining of the brain that protects the brain, just like we do in the gut, those efforts are really guided and focused at reducing inflammation, which is, as mentioned, the fundamental process here. So, interestingly enough, it does still get back to the gut, because what we now understand about the blood-brain barrier is it is highly sensitive to a particular, what's called a certain type of fat, short-chain fatty acid called butyrate, which is made by the gut bacteria. We count on our gut bacteria to make that chemical butyrate that shores up the blood-brain barrier to protect the brain.
Yes, we do. We count on our gut bacteria for a plethora of critical functions. We're discovering more of them all the time. I've been thinking about how, from the birth of our species, we have co-evolved with the microorganisms that live within our bodies. But some of the leading scientists and researchers who are studying the human microbiome today say we are experiencing an extinction within that parallels the extinction of species gripping the planet. You've written, David, about the internal ecology of our guts, the health and diversity of the microorganisms that live within it and play such a pivotal role in our neurological and mental health. What I want to ask you is, could the decline in the diversity within our microbiome be responsible in some degree for the skyrocketing rates of serious neurological diseases we are experiencing?
Well, I think that there's very little doubt that that is a very strong possibility. I've been recently did an interview with an individual who really correlated the risk of Alzheimer's in various parts of the world in comparison to the diversity of organisms found in those individuals who live in those countries. The conclusion was that the more hygienically neurotic we become, the greater is our risk for inflammatory diseases like Alzheimer's. And this really plays upon this whole, what's called the hypothesis, the hygiene hypothesis, that the more we're taking antibiotics and sterilizing our hands and not exposing ourselves to germs, the more imbalance there is in our immune systems and the higher degree of inflammation we will experience. So I had the opportunity to interview the author of that study, Dr. Molly Fox, who is at UCLA, and what a terrific source of logic and information she was. A very, very extensive study looking at over 100 countries, and the correlation is really perfect. Those countries where they have lots of parasites in the gut, which we used to think is a terrible thing, and lots of gut diversity, had the lowest levels of Alzheimer's as compared to, you know, westernized countries where everybody gets an antibiotic every time they have a sniffle, and, you know, the notion of parasites is something that makes you think like you're unclean and you need to get some kind of vigorous treatment. So you're right, John, that we've had this beautiful symbiotic relationship with those organisms living within us that have not only interacted with our metabolism, how we handle food, but also have directly interacted with our DNA, that our microbiome, this 100 trillion organisms living within us, has actively communicated with our own 23,000 genome that we got from mom and dad and all the generations before us, and they have this beautiful crosstalk. They're talking back and forth to do nothing more than to make John Robbins healthy. It's really something to get your arms around, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. And, you know, one of the things you just said actually is counterintuitive to a lot of us. I mean, ridding our bodies of nasty microorganisms and germs has been a goal of medicine since the invention of the microscope. I think antibiotics may be the signature medical achievement of the 20th century. Drugs like penicillin and streptomycin have saved millions of lives. And this has led many of us to see the world as a place filled with germs that we need to destroy. And germophobia has become big business. We have antibacterial and antimicrobial agents everywhere. They're not just in cleaning products. They're bonded into the surface of credit cards and countertops. They're in baby bibs and plastic kitchen tools. They're bonded into cutting boards and high chairs and toys. Even while there is mounting scientific evidence that you referred to a moment ago that they have a multitude of serious adverse health effects. David, no one wants to bring back the killers of yore. No one wants to see outbreaks of cholera or tuberculosis or bacterial meningitis. But we are paying a greater price for our germophobia than we often realize. What is that price?
I think it's several fold. There is clearly the discussion of antibiotic-resistant organisms, the threat that sooner than later there will be bugs, superbugs, for which there are no pharmaceutical remedies. And I think maybe we'll table that for another day. It's another discussion. What I would like to talk about is the changes in the human microbiome that happen when we're exposed to antibiotics through taking medication, through all the other issues that you just presented. But keeping in mind the fact that 70% or so of the antibiotics used in America actually are used in the raising of cattle and poultry. And so we are compromising the diversity of our microbiome daily through, again, some of the issues you've raised, but even through taking non-antibiotic medications. We know, for example, there's a powerful effect on the microbiome by taking drugs that change the pH or the acidity versus alkalinity of the gut. And what I'm referring to are acid-blocking drugs, and specifically what are called the proton pump inhibitors. And these are the drugs that are advertised on the evening news that everybody thinks they need to take, because when they eat a certain food, they get an upset stomach. You can't eat a sausage until you take your whatever it is, your Pepcid AC, and the next thing you know, you can eat whatever you want. If you're having indigestion, whatever that may mean, from eating a certain food, the first thing you should say is, gee, there's a message here. Maybe I shouldn't be eating this food, rather than thinking you've got to block stomach acid, and that's going to make everything okay. The Journal of the American Medical Association last year, in their specialty journal, Neurology, published a very extensive study demonstrating that people who chronically take acid-blocking drugs have a 40% higher risk of dementia. Well, why would that be? Again, it gets back to the gut-brain connection. When you change the pH of the entire intestinal system, the entire digestive system, you change the environment, and certain bacteria are going to live and others are going to perish. And you change that balance that you referred to a few minutes ago that has existed in this relationship between us and our microbiome for, let's say, 2 million years. Suddenly you turn the tables on these bacteria, and inflammation is increased. Coronary artery disease is increased. Stanford University demonstrated about a 16% increased risk of heart attack in people taking those types of drugs. And if you have that heart attack, your risk of dying from it is doubled just from taking this seemingly harmless acid-blocking drug. We know that the non-steroid anti-inflammatories do exactly the same thing. They ultimately lead to increased inflammation and significantly increased risk for heart disease. Now, what did I just say? Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs increase the very thing that they are purported to reduce, inflammation.
When you were talking so powerfully about the impact of certain medications on disease risk and Alzheimer's in particular, I was thinking about that some of our listeners might be thinking, well, I'm never going to take antibiotics again. And it's absolutely true that we grossly overuse these medicines. And it's absolutely true, as you mentioned, that the flagrant use of them and actually unnecessary use of them in industrial meat production is leading to antibiotic resistant bacteria that is can be a really medical problem of enormous magnitude. But are there circumstances that you, David, would take antibiotics? And if that was necessary, David, how would you seek afterwards to restore your microbiome?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is I would absolutely take antibiotics if they were necessary. My father had bacterial endocarditis and was at home. I couldn't practice brain surgery for 6 weeks because he was at home on an IV of penicillin. Had it not been for penicillin, he would have died. So, you know, there is clearly a place for antibiotics. The CDC tells us that 30% of the antibiotic prescriptions written in America are absolutely unnecessary. That's from our own Centers for Disease Control. So, yes, it's a risk in terms of creating these resistant organisms. But, you know, the upside is that there are wonderful remedies for powerfully dangerous bacterial infections. I mentioned just one. Would I take an antibiotic? You darn right I would. If I had a bacterial infection that I was at risk for, you know, getting worse, absolutely I would. Do I travel with antibiotics? You bet I do. If I go to some pretty scary places in terms of not being having available medical care. That said, I do take probiotics every single day, and I would redouble those dosages if I were taking an antibiotic, A. B, I would space those probiotics as far away daily from the antibiotic dosage as I could. And C, I would continue taking that double dosage of probiotics for several weeks after the antibiotic course. So there's lots of things to keep in mind to try to offset the downside of an antibiotic regimen.
When I think about the role the diet plays in the health of the microbiome, I always think about the soybean and corn crop in the United States. Nearly all of it is GMO, genetically engineered. And as a result, most of the processed foods in American supermarkets contain unlabeled GMO ingredients. And almost all of the soy and corn has been sprayed with massive amounts of the herbicide Roundup. In fact, that's what it's been genetically engineered to withstand, and that it's used in massive amounts on these crops. And the primary ingredient of Roundup, of course, is glyphosate. 1 million tons of this toxic herbicide are used annually in the U.S. corn and soy crops, also on the wheat crops in a different fashion. There's evidence, there's a lot of evidence that glyphosate, the ingredient used in this ubiquitous Roundup, may disrupt and kill beneficial bacteria in our guts. And this can lead to impaired immune function and a cascade of ill health effects. So what I want to ask you, David, are really two questions. What impact does glyphosate have on gut bacteria? And secondly, could the rise in gluten intolerance and celiac disease that we're seeing be due in part to this herbicide being used in such enormous quantities?
I think that this question was the subject of research by Dr. Stephanie Seneff, who is at MIT, and she published a wonderful review in the Journal of Biological Physics and Chemistry back in 2015. And what Dr. Seneff was able to determine was, first, that there is significant disruption of our gut bacteria based upon exposure to glyphosate, and that it was her contention that because of that disruption and the effects that disruption of our gut bacteria have on immune balance, as you and I discussed a little while ago, that this could certainly be related to the uptick in celiac disease, which is an autoimmune condition. What you just talked about, I think, is really profound, and that is, you know, when you're at the cocktail party and people are asking you, you know, are you in favor of GMO foods, and you say no, when they ask the next question, which is why, here's the answer, and you touched on it, and that is that when we genetically modify our soy and our corn, for example, the reason it's genetically modified is to allow the farmers to spray those crops, 90% of the corn, 90% of the soy grown in America, with this herbicide, glyphosate. They can kill the weeds, but the corn and the soy are just fine. The problem with that is residues of glyphosate then remain on that food that is then fed to our cattle, that is then fed to our children, and that we eat as well. That's the dirty little secret of GMO that people don't want to talk about. So while, you know, the science of the danger of GMO is not so in the spotlight as yet, the part that it paves the way for, this exposure to glyphosate that the World Health Organization has now characterized as a probable human carcinogen, that's part of this dirty little secret that I really think people need to talk about. When the World Health Organization came out and said that, and it was published actually in the journal Lancet Oncology back in 2015, that was very difficult for them to do, and yet they did it. They came out and said glyphosate is a probable, not possible, human, not rodent, laboratory animal, cancer-causing agent. And to this day, it's breathtaking to me when you drive down the street and you see people spraying this glyphosate in people's yards with a backpack full of this stuff, wearing no protective equipment whatsoever. That's one part of the story. But the other part of the story is it's in our food, and that's very, very worrisome.
It is very worrisome. There are so many things about our food supply that worry me. Many people who want to lose weight drink non-calorically sweetened beverages, beverages sweetened with aspartame, which is sold as NutraSweet and as Equal, or sucralose, which is sold as Splenda. And there's other non-caloric sweeteners too, but it doesn't work. Studies have consistently found that these people end up actually gaining more weight than if they drank typical sugar-sweetened sodas. David, might this be this sort of a paradoxical outcome, that they gain more weight than they would if they were drinking a caloric, a sugar-sweetened soda? Might this be because of changes in the gut bacteria that are caused by the synthetic sweeteners?
Well, I think that there's been wonderful research that has actually supported that contention. And, you know, it just seems paradoxical that people are trying their very best to lose weight. You know, and what are they doing? They're saying no more sugar. I've heard that sugar is addictive and it's making me fat through insulin upregulation, et cetera. I'm going to drink artificially sweetened this and that. Well, that's all well and good, but you know, studies published, for example, in the journal Obesity, dating way back to 2008, large studies looking at 5,000-6,000 individuals have demonstrated dramatic weight gain in those who have not been drinking sugar-sweetened beverages, but rather are drinking beverages that have been sweetened with, as you mentioned, artificial sweeteners. It doesn't make any sense. Well, it didn't make sense until Israeli researchers publishing in the journal Nature back in September 2014 did both animal and human studies demonstrating significant changes in the microbiome, in the gut bacteria, when both animals and humans were exposed to these non-caloric sweeteners, and showed mechanisms whereby this leads to significant, these changes then lead to increased weight gain. So even to the extent that they would give humans artificial sweeteners in their diets, then transplant their fecal material into a laboratory mouse, and that laboratory mouse would then gain weight.
Oh, my God.
So simply what happens is these microorganisms, these changes that happen in the microbiome, trick the body into thinking that it is starving, and then the body does everything it can to hold on to calories because we're starving. That's the changes that are induced in the gut bacteria. So the speed of transit, for example, that how quickly things move through the gut is slowed way down by some direct signaling mechanisms from the gut to the top of the intestines. So the food lingers in your stomach longer and you're able to extract more calories. Interestingly, the same sort of changes in the gut take place that increase risk for type 2 diabetes. So strangely, we see increased risk of type 2 diabetes dramatically in people using sugar-free beverages. And one can only imagine when a diabetic is seeing his or her doctor what the choice would be recommended by the doctor in terms of should I drink a Coke or a Diet Coke. You know, you know what the answer is, and likely that's actually wrong. That's the wrong recommendation. So to take this to its end, a very clever researcher in Amsterdam, Dr. Max Neudorp, decided that he would try to treat type 2 diabetes by doing fecal transplantation, putting fecal material from healthy, lean donors into those overweight individuals with type 2 diabetes. And in over 200 individuals, he reversed the parameters of diabetes in these people by transplanting their gut bacteria. So, you know, obviously that hasn't taken on widespread application as yet for this rampant disease, type 2 diabetes. But that said, you know, what a forward-thinking researcher, and it just really emphasizes the fundamental importance of this array of good bacteria that we need to have to be healthy.
It really does. It really does. When you were talking about sugar-sweetened beverages and non-calorically sweetened beverages actually being worse in so many ways, I was thinking, well, we really should be drinking water a lot more than we are. And most of our drinking water is treated with chlorine and other chemicals to keep it free from toxic microbes. Now, what effect does drinking water that has chlorine in it or bromine in it have on our microbiomes? And would you suggest that we drink filtered water?
Answer the first question is, if the reason we have residual chlorine in our municipal water systems is to have a sterilization from the water plant to your spigot in your kitchen, your faucet. So they put the chlorine in to sterilize the entire delivery system all the way up to your drink, your glass. And that said, we don't want to be drinking a liquid that's going to kill bacteria. Now, Do I think that there are dangers of bacteria in municipal systems? Sure. And I think that, you know, they have to do that, but that doesn't mean we have to drink that. So should the water be filtered? Yes. You know, how effective are filters that are commercially available to remove chlorine? That's a subject of debate. We have installed a reverse osmosis system that not only takes chlorine out, but bigger things like bacteria, particles, lead, and you name it. So I think the quality and purity of our drinking water is one of the most important health choices a person can make. So it's really very, very important.
We also have reverse osmosis units here, by the way. I want to ask you another question about this gut-brain connection and our health. We're learning more and more that the food we eat affects our physical health, and we're learning more and more that it affects our mental health, our cognitive capacities, and our risks for things like dementia. Is it true that the gut has a brain, and that brain makes serotonin, in fact, makes more serotonin, which is called the master happiness molecule, than the brain in our heads does? And if that's so, could this be one of the explanations for why antidepressants are often less effective in treating depression than dietary changes are?
Well, truly the effectiveness of what are now the most common form of antidepressant, these SSRI antidepressants, is marginal at best. So the difference between placebo and an antidepressant in terms of efficacy is almost negligible. The premise for these SSRIs was to somehow increase the availability and effectiveness of serotonin, the happy chemical, in the brain. We now recognize that our body's production of serotonin, 90% of which occurs in the gut, is very, very much regulated by a mechanism called inflammation. Who knew? When you look at the metabolism of the amino acid tryptophan, it can be shuttled to make serotonin, and the way it is shuttled to make serotonin, if there's inflammation, less serotonin is made because less tryptophan is made available for that pathway. So that said, we know that even levels of serotonin are much more dramatically influenced in the presence of, based upon what's going on in the gut, as opposed to the effectiveness of changing serotonin in the brain by damaging the enzyme that would normally have degraded it. But here's what's really, I think, much more important, and that is we're now recognizing that the effectiveness of this class of drugs, SSRIs, the Prozacs, Paxils, that type of antidepressant, is dependent upon a process in the brain called neurogenesis, which means the growth of new brain cells. In order for those drugs to work, even the marginal way that they work, nonetheless, is dependent on the growth of new brain cells. If brain cells are not growing as readily as they could be or should be, then the drugs are going to be much less effective. Now, that said, we know that mood is influenced by the degree of growth of new brain cells. So, I mean, first of all, understand that when I went to medical school, we were told that the brain never grew new brain cells. But now, since the work of Dr. Peter Erickson, published just in 1998, I might add, we now recognize that this is something going on in all of us throughout our lifetimes. Yes, we grow new brain cells in the brain's memory center called the hippocampus. That does two really good things for us. It helps us with our mood, and obviously, it's going to help us with our memory. So I'm hoping your next question is, well, then what can we do to enhance the growth of brain cells? I know that's what you're going to ask me, right?
David, what can we do to enhance the growth of our brain cells?
So there's no drug for that, except for one, and it's very, very expensive. It's called buying a pair of sneakers. Turns out that aerobic exercise is dramatic in terms of changing gene expression to allow our genes to make a chemical called BDNF that makes our brain grow new brain cells. And that will improve our mood and improve our cognitive performance and put us possibly at a 50% reduced risk for Alzheimer's. And that was published last year by Dr. Peter Erickson, no relation, at UCLA. So all you got to do is aerobically exercise, and you dramatically increase the growth of new brain cells, good for your mood, good for your memory, reduce your risk of Alzheimer's disease. We don't have a pill for that. Other things that increase BDNF and therefore the growth of new brain cells are the herb turmeric, drinking coffee, and new products are coming out now that are made actually from the fruit of the coffee berry or the coffee cherry. So when you make coffee, you eat the seed, but this is actually made from the fruit.
When you were talking about exercise and running shoes, aerobic exercise, I was thinking about many studies that I've seen that show that exercise is a much more effective treatment for depression than any of the classes of antidepressant drugs that are on the market.
Well, you're right. And, you know, what we're seeing now is that depression is considered an inflammatory disorder that may very well have its genesis in the gut. A wonderful book written by Dr. Emron Mayer at UCLA talks all about mood and the microbiome. I believe that's the part of the title. So we're learning now that the gut is playing a huge role in regulating our mood, and that aerobic exercise regulates our mood as well because it increases BDNF. But here's what is really perhaps the most important part of that story that I don't know that I've ever mentioned before in an interview, and that is we know that exercise increases the diversity of the gut bacteria. Now, that's pretty exciting in and of itself. So when you there's a correlation, rather, between those who do a lot of exercise and their degree of bacterial diversity in their gut. So having said that, we know then that this may be the mechanism, because depression is an inflammatory disorder. If you exercise, sure, you're making your endorphins, and maybe that's playing a role, but you're also increasing your diversity of your gut bacteria, and that in turn will increase your protection against inflammation. So what an incredible study that looked at this relationship between aerobic exercise and increased diversity of gut bacteria. Pretty exciting, published in the journal Microbiome, of all places.
This is exciting. We are breathtakingly on the leading edge here of discoveries that are can rewrite the way we think about ourselves and our health. And I'm thinking about something. Mother's milk, human breast milk, it's obviously the ideal food for human infants. And with all the disagreements and controversies in the diet world, this is one reality that has nearly universal agreement. And yet, we know that about a third of human breast milk is actually composed of a class of sugars that human babies cannot digest. Now, the question naturally arises then, why would human breast milk contains substances seemingly useless to their babies? David, might the sugars in mother's milk that human babies cannot digest be there for the purpose of nourishing the beneficial bacteria that live in babies' intestines?
Well, the answer is absolutely. And, you know, further understand that human breast milk contains prebiotic fiber, if you will, called galacto-oligosaccharides. And these galacto-oligosaccharides are not used for the infant's metabolism in any way, but serve to nurture that infant's gut bacteria. So mother is directly targeting infant microbiome development based upon things like breastfeeding. But let's take a step back and talk about where did those seeds for that infant's microbiome come from? They were acquired as that infant passed through the birth canal. So that's when that child was anointed with bacteria that then went on to form his or her microbiome, to balance that child's immune system, to reduce that child's risk for allergic issues, for example. We now see research that demonstrates if mothers take probiotics And during pregnancy and breastfeeding, that has a further effect in terms of reducing risk for certain inflammatory issues like eczema in their children. The other thing to consider is, therefore, if you bypass this anointment, birth through the birth canal and do a cesarean section, those kids, and I'm trying not to be critical here, but children born by C-section have a dramatic increased risk for autism, ADHD, allergic issues, and even adult obesity, 50% increased risk of adult obesity. Significant increase for autoimmune conditions, including celiac disease, as well as type 1 diabetes. Now, I'm not mommy bashing here, but I do want to make this statement. In the United States, where one-third of all births is now cesarean section, that the discussion between the obstetrician and the parents-to-be needs to be a little bit more extensive than simply how long will the scar be and how many more days am I going to be in the hospital. This event, the process of being born vaginally versus through cesarean section, has lifelong consequences on that new person. And I think that's a really important discussion to have with parents-to-be. There's a wonderful researcher at NYU, Maria Dominguez-Bello, who has done so much work in this area and who has come up with a technique whereby if you've got to have a C-section, you put a gauze, a 4x4 in the birth canal prior to having the baby born, delivered by C-section, keep it in take it out, put it in a warm, moist environment, and then as soon as the baby's born, you cover that baby's nose and mouth with this gauze that was in the birth canal.
Wow.
As a way of giving that kid back his or her bacteria. She's demonstrated in a new study that came out in the journal Nature that, in fact, those organisms that they culture from the mother's birth canal that were then transplanted with this technique are viable nine months out and recoverable from the infant's bowel movement, from the infant's feces. So, there will very likely soon be some kind of product to give to babies born by C-section. C-sections save lives. They're a very valuable technique that we have if mother's life is threatened, if infant's life is threatened. But again, you know, the notion that a third of all births in America is that complicated, that it requires a C-section, is a bit of a stretch, in my opinion.
Well, I see an analogy. C-sections and antibiotics both save lives. They're both, when necessary, marvelous, but are vastly overused and have really, really negative consequences to our microbiomes.
Yeah, we always have to look at risk-benefit, and I think we're only just beginning to look at risk for C-sections. I mean, you know, it's really time that people embrace the fact that this is not a free ride. Certainly, we're looking at the risks of antibiotic exposure. That's been talked about now for several decades.
It seems like we should be doing everything we can to keep our gut bacteria diverse and happy and healthy, and to restrict life choices and food choices that would lessen the diversity of our gut bacteria. We want to have the entire orchestra playing, and that means a healthy diet that's filled in particular with, as you've mentioned repeatedly in this conversation, prebiotic fiber. When I think of foods that are rich in prebiotic fiber, I think of onions and leeks and garlic, and I think of artichoke and asparagus and all kinds of greens, mm-hmm. perhaps particularly dandelion greens.
My favorite.
Are there other foods that are good sources?
Well, you've really covered a lot of the list. Chicory and jicama, I don't think you mentioned, also really good sources. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, most vegetables do contain some levels of prebiotic fiber. But, you mentioned the big ones, garlic, onions, leeks, chicory, dandelion greens, jicama, asparagus, Jerusalem artichoke as well. But, you know, there are organic, non-GMO, prebiotic fiber nutritional supplements available at the health food store. And, you know, nobody's probably getting enough prebiotic fiber. So there are wonderful supplements that are made from things like acacia gum. Acacia is that tree in Africa, that tall canopy tree that you see the giraffe trying to get out of the noonday sun underneath. And it secretes a gum or a resin that is then sustainably harvested, made into a powder, and is available in health food stores around the country. So there are ways of getting lots and lots of good prebiotic fiber.
Well, David, you have brought attention to something of that we can all see now is of singular importance. A compelling body of evidence tells us that the trillions of bacteria that our bodies play host to have profound influences on our health, on our daily lives, on our destinies. We have a hidden world inside us, and that determines nearly everything about our health and well-being. The medical profession and most of us have been unaware of this, and some of the treatments that Western medicine routinely employs are actually counterproductive to our health, as you've been pointing out. But you're helping us to awaken to the remarkable importance of our inner garden, our microbiome, our gut bacteria. It's really a delight for me to realize that most bacteria are not our enemy, but really are.
By and large, you're right. That's for sure. They're mostly there trying to help us.
They're essential allies to us in creating vibrant health, and you show us that again and again. On behalf of myself and of Ocean, and really of everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I thank you, David, for your beautiful work, for your beautiful way of expressing it too, and your deep caring, and for being with us today.
Well, John, it's my pleasure, and Ocean, thanks for all your work in putting this together. I just have honored your work for such a long time, and you know, I want to just close with a quote from Emerson that is, do not go where the path may lead, go instead where there is no path and leave a trail. And I think that so many of us, you know, are really jumping off the path, jumping off the trail, because we realize that we don't like where the path is leading, and we want to leave a trail to a place that's better, and that's all we're trying to do here. And it's not to be necessarily iconoclastic, but really just to, you know, to do the small work that we can do to help people live a healthier and happier life.
So true. We've been talking with brilliant trailblazer neurologist Dr. David Perlmutter, co-founder and president of the Perlmutter Brain Foundation, and best-selling author of numerous books, including Brain Maker, The Power of Gut Microbes to Heal and Protect Your Brain for Life. David, your research and your leadership in understanding the critical role of microbiome and bacteriological diversity is helping millions to move towards healthier brains and healthier lives. We're so grateful for your leadership, for your cutting-edge insights into some of the most critical health issues of our times, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you, and again, it was my delight and honor to be with you today.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.